On the air to demonstrate the kind of service we will be providing every day of the week, starting during the summer. What we are seeking is a license to transmit from the United Kingdom, instead of hiring transmission facilities abroad. If you would like our specially printed QSL card, please send 50 pence in British stamps or 3 international reply coupons to Radio Fax No. 1, High Ash Farm, Case Store St Edmund, England, NR148RH. And don't forget that every letter we receive helps our application for a licence to transmit from England.
A report from the media correspondent of the Financial Times for the need to secure Channel 4 funds. Channel 4 has expressed its strongest opposition so far to possible privatisation or exposure to direct competition in the marketplace for its advertising finance. When Mr. Michael Grade, Chief Executive of Channel 4, told the Commons Home Affairs Committee yesterday that adequate and secure funding was essential if the channel was to honour its remit to provide innovative and diverse programming. The worst thing that could happen to Channel 4, Mr. Grade argued, would be to turn it into an independent channel with its income directly related to audiences and advertising revenue. That would immediately put Channel 4 in competition with ITV and BBC and would certainly reduce choice for the viewer. The viewer would be the loser in that situation, Mr. Grade said, who appeared to be in favour of Channel 4 privatisation when he was a senior BBC executive. He said he would dread it if we're in a position that links income directly to the marketplace. At the moment, Channel 4 is a subsidiary of the Independent Broadcasting Authority, a constitutional position Mr. Grade said worked very well. The channel and the Welsh Fourth Channel, SC4, are funded by an annual subscription from the ITV companies. Although Mr. Grade emphasised the vital importance of secure and adequate funding, he told the committee it was not so important to the channel, who actually sold its advertising time. At the moment, the ITV companies sell the channel's airtime, but the government is considering separate selling of advertising to increase competition.
From International Broadcast Engineer magazine, Developments in Broadcast Transmitter Engineering by Sean Metcalf, Incomtel. Transmitters and antennas for broadcast transmission represent a high capital expenditure and are, therefore, designed for a long working life. Indeed, there are examples of MF and HF transmitters designed during the 30s that are still performing reliably in service. The broadcast transmission situation, therefore, contrasts sharply with that encountered in studio engineering, where equipment can become obsolete and due for replacement within a few years. The relatively slow rate at which new transmitter and antenna designs are developed and brought into service does not mean that important developments have not taken place. New thermionic valve and solid-state techniques have resulted in a steady increase in the RF output power available from transmitters, and significant improvements have been made in the precision with which complex antennas can be designed. Reductions in the capital and revenue costs of transmitters have been achieved by, for example, significantly increased efficiency in the conversion of input mains power to transmitted RF power. With the rising cost of electrical power throughout the world, this has resulted in large revenue savings, reductions in overall transmitter dimensions which have resulted in reduced building costs. Improved transmitter reliability and improved methods of fault diagnosis and repair have resulted, mainly, from the introduction of computer and solid-state techniques and have substantially reduced maintenance costs. Automatic unattended transmitter operation has reduced operational and maintenance staff requirements. Developments in these fields are continuing, and in the future will offer increasing advantages to the broadcaster. Single sideband AM broadcasting, SSB, the advantages of which have been known for many years, is now receiving serious attention. The World Administrative Radio Conference, WARC, has resolved that SSB should be introduced in stages in the HF band, with a complete changeover being achieved by the year 2015. As a result, SSB transmitter design problems have been studied and high-efficiency transmitters are now available for this mode of transmission. LF, MF and HF transmitters. Efficiency. The output powers of early LF, MF and HF broadcast transmitters were modest, and 30 kilowatts was regarded as high power. These transmitters were large and inefficient and required full-time staff for operation and maintenance. The large size resulted from the low gain of available vowels, which meant that many stages of amplification were required. The overall efficiency was in the region of only 25% to 30% and resulted mainly from the use of low-level modulation followed by linear amplifier stages. However, as early as the 1930s, the Doherty high-efficiency amplifier and the Class B anode modulator were developed and gave very significant improvements in efficiency with consequent reductions in operating cost. The linear amplifier is inefficient because the valves only achieve high efficiency at 100% peak modulation. In the Doherty amplifier, one valve carries signals with an amplitude up to the level of steady carrier, and a second valve carries the peaks of modulation. In the Class B anode modulator, the voltage at the anode of the RF Class C output valve is varied by a linear Class B balanced AF amplifier via a large iron cord modulation transformer and choke. In the Doherty and Class B anode modulated systems, increased efficiency is achieved because the RF valves operate near saturation at 0 and 100% modulation. However, in both cases, the efficiency falls at intermediate levels of modulation. It is also worth mentioning the Tyler third harmonic technique, widely used to improve the efficiency of all transmitters using Class C RF amplifiers. Output power. To improve coverage, there has been a steady increase in the output power requirement for LF, MF and HF transmitters. Currently, transmitters with a single RF output valve and delivering 1 megawatt or more in the LF and MF bands and 500 kilowatts in the HF band are available. These powers have been made possible by the use of pyrolytic graphite grids and improved methods of valve construction and cooling. Pyrolytic graphite grids can be precision cut by sandblasting or laser cutting, resulting in precise, repeatable geometry and three times the power dissipation of a conventional grid of the same size. Anode cooling of high-power valves by the vapor phase method, steam cooling, in which advantage is taken of latent heat to reduce the volume of coolant, has been in common use for some years. Pulse duration modulation, PDM. The Doherty and Class B anode modulation systems achieve overall transmitter efficiencies in the range 55% to 65% and are still in common use. Although these efficiencies are a great improvement on those of earlier transmitters, the lost energy still represents a considerable revenue expenditure in the case of high-power transmitters. Thus, with the rising cost of electrical energy, there has been a continued search for higher efficiency, and the most significant advance has been the development of the PDM system. This comprises a high-efficiency Class C RF amplifier, whose HT is provided by a switch and an AF filter. Due to the action of the switch, the valve only passes current when its anode resistance is at a minimum, and its efficiency is consequently high. Unlike the Doherty and Class B anode modulated systems, the efficiency of the output stage increases with modulation depth, and overall transmitter efficiencies in the region of 70% can be achieved. Dynamic carrier control, DCC. In conventional double sideband AM transmission, only the sidebands carry the program information, and the carrier power can be considered as wasted energy. This problem will, of course, be solved when SSB is eventually introduced. Attempts have been made over many years to reduce the wasted carrier energy, but without success. Recently, however, such techniques have become practicable, due to the availability of effective methods of carrier control. Dynamic carrier control was first introduced in commercially available transmitters by AEG under the designation DAM, Volume Dependent Amplitude Modulation, or Dynamic Amplitude Modulation. In one approach, the carrier level for low modulation is set below its full modulation value and increased dynamically to accommodate higher levels of modulation. In another approach, a conventional unmodulated carrier level is adopted, and the complete modulated output, carrier and sidebands, is compressed at high modulation levels. In both these approaches, the action of the receiver AGC results in audio distortion, which limits the amount of power saving that can be achieved. In the first system, the AGC results in a compression of the audio signal and an increase of noise in quiet program passages. In the second system, the AGC cannot compensate completely for the compression of the transmitted signal. However, significant reductions in mains power are possible, and DCC is now incorporated in commercially available high power transmitters.
Say they want to bring me in guilty for the killing of a deputy, for the life of a deputy. But I say, I shot the sheriff, but I swear it was in self-defense. I swear it was in self-defense. I shot the sheriff, but I swear it was in self-defense. Freedom came my way one day, and I started out in town fair. All of a sudden I see sheriff. So I shot him down.
Continuing with Sean Metcalfe's article, Developments in Broadcast Transmitter Engineering, LF-MF Transmitter Design. At low carrier powers, the main development has been in the solid-state field, and transmitters with up to 50 kilowatts output power are now available in an all-solid-state form. The power available from a single transistor is low, and high powers can only be achieved by the operation of a number of output modules in parallel, with consequent circuit complexity. Efficiency is of less importance at lower output powers, but many all-solid-state designs use either the Doherty linear amplifier or PDM, since these eliminate the need for a modulation choke and transformer with a consequent reduction in overall transmitter dimensions. For example, 10 kilowatt AM broadcast transmitters are available with average dimensions in the region of 200 centimetres high by 100 centimetres wide by 65 centimetres deep, and overall efficiencies in excess of 70%. At powers above 50 kilowatts, tetrode output stages are commonly used, and many current designs use a PDM modulator. The application of PDM at very high powers presents a number of problems, and these have been overcome in different ways by different manufacturers. The Marconi PulseAM system, the AEG Pantel system, and the Continental system use a switching valve in series with the RF output amplifier. The Brown-Boveri PSM pulse step modulator, on the other hand, uses successive switching of solid-state power modules with increasing modulation depth, so that a switching valve is not required. All these variations on the theme of PDM give high overall transmitter efficiencies, but it remains to be seen which will ultimately prove to be most effective in service. Transmitter designs using dynamic carrier control or an allied system known as DPDM, dynamically controlled PDM, are now available commercially. An application of this technique is that an add-on unit can be designed to improve the efficiency of some types of existing transmitter. HF transmitter design. Developments in HF transmitter design have followed those in the LF-MF field as regards output power, increased efficiency, and smaller size. However, an exception is that the Doherty design is not suitable, as it is difficult to tune in the short time available, around 15 seconds, for changes in operating frequency. The maximum available transmitter output power is 500 kilowatts, and in most cases, tetrode output stages with PDM are used. The 500 kilowatts maximum transmitter power is dictated partly by available valve designs and partly by the difficulty of designing high-gain antennas that will carry the peak voltages associated with higher powers. Early designs of HF transmitter required changing of the tank circuit components, but all current designs include automatic, remotely controlled frequency changing. Control circuits commonly use a combination of solid state and relay logic, start-stop control commands being provided for all transmitter functions. Transmitter and antenna control and monitoring allow remote or extended control from a video terminal. Multi-channel operation is provided with channel frequencies stored in the control computer memory. Thousands of operating logs can be stored and reviewed. The trend is increasingly to unattended operation, although the high voltages involved and the complexity of the frequency and antenna switching make it difficult to envisage a complete withdrawal of maintenance staff at HF transmitting stations. It is worth pointing out, however, that there is still a role for simple transmitters with semi-manual operation for tropical broadcasting applications, where few frequency changes are required and maintenance facilities are often limited. VHF and UHF transmitters, solid-state techniques. Recently, considerable effort has been applied to the design of VHF and UHF all-solid-state transmitters with output powers up to about 30 kilowatts, and possibly eventually to 50 kilowatts. An all-solid-state transmitter has obvious advantages as regards reliability and safety. A 30-volt supply voltage can be used. The increased reliability results from the use of a number of parallel paths in the output stage where it can be arranged that the failure of any path will result in only a small reduction in output power. Transistors are inherently more reliable than valves, although this is offset to some extent by the fact that they can be damaged by short-term overload and complex protection circuits are required. Valves, on the other hand, are rugged and can sustain short-term overloads without failure. It is not yet possible to say whether all solid-state transmitters will completely replace valve types, including those with high output powers. It can be said, however, that neither type of equipment is ideal for every user. Valves offer simplicity, relative cheapness, and ease of maintenance. All solid-state transmitters offer high reliability at the expense of greater complexity. Tetrode valves. The design of high-power valves becomes more difficult with increasing frequency. An early designs of VHF and UHF tetrode had limited gain, up to 6 dB, and limited anode and grid dissipation. The use of the pyrolytic graphite material in LF, MF, HF transmitters, together with improved methods of construction, has made available valves with much improved performance. Tetrode gains of around 15 dB are now possible, and together with modern solid-state techniques, single-valve transmitters with output powers of up to 100 kilowatts in the VHF band and up to 30 kilowatts in the UHF band are possible. For television applications, it is possible to use a single tetrode for common vision sound amplifications. There is an obvious saving of one complete transmitter chain and the vision sound diplexer, but against this, the generation of intermodulation products between vision and sound signals means that a higher capacity tetrode, derated, must be used. As a result, common vision sound amplification is not normally used at vision output powers above 10 kilowatts in the VHF band and 5 kilowatts in the UHF band, except as a standby facility in the event of failure of the vision or sound transmitter. UHF klystrons. The klystron has a much higher gain than the tetrode, in excess of 30 dB, as opposed to around 15 dB. And thus simplifies transmitter design by reducing the drive power requirement. Current transmitter designs have output powers up to the 60 kilowatt range with a single klystron, an all-solid-state drive. The disadvantage of the klystron is its low efficiency, which results from the fact that the beam current must be capable of accommodating the peaks of the synchronizing pulses. Further, early UHF klystron designs were based on types intended for completely different applications, for instance, tropospheric scatter. For these reasons, the efficiency of early klystron amplifiers was in the region of only 30%, and the overall efficiency of a vision sound transmitting equipment was around 20%. Considerable development work based on computer modelling has taken place to develop klystron designs with improved efficiency and wide operating bandwidth. This work has resulted in external cavity klystrons with efficiencies in the region of 45%, an operating bandwidth covering the UHF band 470 to 860 MHz, and with output powers up to the 60 kilowatt range. Attempts to raise klystron efficiency have been made using the depressed collector technique, where the objective is to reduce power dissipation in the collector by reducing the operating potential. But it has not proved possible to overcome the degradation in performance resulting from electrons reflected from the collector and travelling back down the drift tube. A much more effective means of raising efficiency is the pulsed klystron, in which the beam current is kept at black level during the period of the picture signal. During the synchronizing period, the beam current is pulsed to the higher value necessary to accommodate the sync pulses. The pulsed klystron technique is now in common use and results in klystron amplifier efficiencies in the 65 to 75% region. An interesting development is the Class B klystrode, which incorporates a control grid and aims to combine the advantages of klystron high gain and tetrode high efficiency. With the grid, it is possible to vary the beam current continuously so that it is kept at a minimum necessary to accommodate the video signal at all times. Transmitters using the klystrode are available, and it is claimed that, compared with a pulse klystron, reductions of up to 50% in wasted power are possible.
You've got me so confused, and there's one wrong with you.
6220 daytime, 61611 nighttime. This is Radio Fax, the trade station. Number 1, High Ash Farm, Caister St. Edmund, England, NR148RH.
And the final part from international broadcast engineer of Sean Metcalfe's article, Developments in Broadcast Transmitter Engineering. Transmitting antennas. Transmitter antenna design is based on the fundamental electromagnetic equations formulated by James Clerk Maxwell in 1873. Thus, antenna development has not been characterized by the introduction of new devices and improved versions of older devices. Despite this, however, there have been important developments in the field of antenna design, due mainly to the introduction of high-speed computers. Maxwell's equations are difficult to apply to practical problems, and until comparatively recently, new antenna designs were based on approximate calculations and then brought within the required performance specification by model tests. However, it is not easy to model a complex antenna accurately, and it was often necessary to carry out substantial modifications after erection on site. Computer design programs are now available that solve Maxwell's equations arithmetically and determine accurately the antenna radiating currents and input impedance. It is worth noting that input impedance is the most difficult antenna parameter to calculate, and its accurate determination is a test of the effectiveness of an antenna design computer program. LF-MF antennas. Increasing congestion in the MF band has required the design of antennas to increasingly stringent performance specifications. Computer programs have now made it possible to optimize a complex design for maximum gain, maximum coverage, or maximum suppression of radiation in the direction of co-channel stations. The use of computer-aided design enables an antenna system, including the matching network, to be designed with a degree of accuracy that permits prefabrication in the factory and the need for only minor tuning adjustments on site. HF antennas. Log periodic antennas are complex but, unlike other types, can be designed to cover the whole HF broadcast band from 2 to 26.9 MHz. Until the introduction of the high-speed computer, it was very difficult to design a log-periodic antenna for optimum performance, particularly for high-power broadcast applications. However, broadcast log-periodic antennas are now available with a carrier power capability of 500 kilowatts, a gain of around 20 dBi, a constant or variable takeoff angle, and an acceptable VSWR over the band from 6 to 26.9 MHz. High-gain log-periodic antennas are difficult to slew in azimuth and are best suited to dedicated applications over a particular path. For general broadcast applications, the dipole curtain offers an independent choice of vertical and horizontal radiation pattern, and the main beam can be electrically slewed over azimuth angles up to plus or minus 30 degrees. The latest computer-designed versions incorporate independent control of beam shape and slew angle in both the vertical and horizontal planes. Only three versions are required to cover the whole HF broadcast band. If available ground area is limited, the turntable curtain antenna has many advantages and will provide coverage over a complete 360 degrees azimuth. VHF, UHF antennas. In the VHF and UHF bands, antenna radiating elements are stacked vertically to provide high gains. High antenna gain, however, involves a highly directive vertical radiation pattern, and this can make it difficult to achieve optimum coverage at short and medium distances from the transmitter. Computer-aided design enables the antenna current distribution to be shaped to give a VRP providing substantially uniform coverage out to the edge of the service area. VHF FM transmissions in the UK originally used horizontal polarization as it was thought to have advantages as regards area coverage and protection against ignition interference. However, the advent of transistor portable receivers demonstrated clearly that with horizontal polarization, the field near the ground is low and the service area is therefore much reduced. Vertical polarization provides a higher field at ground level, and transmitting antennas are being converted to radiate signals comprising both vertical and horizontal components using circular polarization or slant polarization. Future transmitter and antenna developments. Solid-state techniques. There is no doubt that there will be further application of solid-state techniques to transmitter design, and that, in particular, higher power output stages will be achieved. It is improbable, however, that the power available from a single transistor will be increased dramatically, so that high power will only be possible using a relatively large number of parallel paths, and the maximum power will be limited by circuit complexity. It is unlikely that valves will become obsolete for powers above 100 kilowatts in the LF, MF and HF bands. In the VHF and UHF bands, it is now possible to design all solid-state transmitters with powers in excess of 30 kilowatts. But it is too early to say whether in these bands, tetrode and klystron amplifiers will become obsolete, since, compared with solid-state amplifiers, they offer the advantage of simplicity and cost-effectiveness. Transmitter efficiency. During the past decade, there has been a considerable improvement in transmitter efficiency. In the LF, MF, HF bands, important factors in this improvement have been the introduction of pulse duration modulation and dynamic carrier control, which employs a continuous control of modulation depth by the amplitude of the modulating signal. In the UHF band, the pulse klystron has achieved significant improvements in efficiency, and the klystrode offers further improvement. Transmitter power. To date, there has been a steady increase in the maximum transmitter power available in all broadcast bands, and it is interesting to speculate whether this increase will continue in the future. In this context, it is worth noting that the law of diminishing returns is particularly applicable to increases in transmitter power. For example, in the LF and MF bands, the service area is limited at night by fading and becomes progressively smaller with increasing frequency. Bearing this in mind, it appears unlikely that maximum powers greater than 1 megawatt to 2 megawatt now available can ever be cost-effective. In the HF band, it is difficult to design either curtain or log-periodic broadcast antennas for transmitter powers much in excess of the present maximum of 500 kilowatts. This limitation is fundamental and can only be overcome by the use of larger diameter conductors, which pose severe structural problems. If there is any increase in the maximum power available from HF broadcast transmitters, it is unlikely to be more than to 1 megawatt. Even this appears unlikely, as, on the occasions that a very high power is necessary, it would be more economic to drive a split curtain antenna with two 500 kilowatt transmitters. In the VHF and UHF bands, even with a high effective radiated power, the curvature of the Earth and the shadow effects of obstacles limit coverage, on average, to about 80 kilometers or 50 miles. An increase in transmitter power will not, therefore, result in any very significant increase in coverage and cannot be regarded as cost-effective. It is worth noting, in fact, that the most significant factor in increasing coverage is the effective height of the transmitting antenna. It therefore appears unlikely that there will be any great increase in the maximum powers of VHF and UHF broadcast transmitters in the foreseeable future. Single sideband broadcasting. The WARC has resolved that utilisation of the HF broadcast band should be improved by the introduction of single sideband. The elimination of the carrier and one set of sidebands will double the number of available broadcast channels and reduce the radiated transmitter power required for a given coverage by about 10 to 1. For example, a 10 kilowatt SSB transmitter will give the same coverage as a 100 kilowatt double sideband transmitter. To allow a phasing out period for double sideband receivers, the transmitted carrier level will first be reduced by 6 dB as soon as practicable. Then, not later than December the 31st, 2015, the transmitted carrier will be reduced by 12 dB to the agreed level for single sideband broadcasting. To meet this program, All new transmitters installed after December 1990 should be capable of transmitting single sideband with the alternatives of a 6 dB or 12 dB reduction in carrier level. The transmission of SSB requires new designs of transmitters to achieve high output stage efficiency and receivers which need to regenerate the carrier. In particular, the design of high power, high efficiency SSB broadcast transmitters is far from simple. SSB capable transmitters are now commercially available and their designs are based on the envelope elimination and restoration EER technique, in which the phase and amplitude modulation components of a low power SSB signal are separated. The phase term is a constant amplitude waveform that can be amplified in high-efficiency Class C stages. The amplitude term can be amplified in a linear amplifier and used to high-level modulate the amplified phase term. As pointed out in the introduction, a changeover to SSB transmission in the HF band is scheduled to be completed by 2015. A change to SSB in the MF band would offer advantages, but in view of the technical problems, particularly those posed by a protracted changeover period, a target would be even further in the future.
The BBC has warned British Telecom that it must reduce what they call its exorbitant charges for distributing corporation programmes or face the risk of losing business worth millions of pounds a year. BT charged the BBC more than £10 million during the last financial year for distributing television and radio signals along its network from the studios to corporation transmitters. Mr. Michael Checkland, the BBC Director General, has spoken to Mr. Ian Vellance, Chairman of BT, and left him in no doubt that unless BT reduces its cost, it would be worth the BBC setting up its own telecommunications system. The BBC finds the idea attractive. If we were to spend £25 million just on the basic core distribution, I would get the money back in 2.5 years. Therefore, it's a good business proposition, Mr. Checkland said this week. If, on the other hand, BT wished to reduce their tariffs, I wouldn't have the problem and wouldn't have to spend £25 million. BT refused to talk about Mr. Checkland's ultimatum. We don't discuss our customers' business in public, a spokesman said. The BBC signals, sound or vision, are distributed by BT from the corporation's studios to its transmitters for national broadcast, principally by microwave links. Many television programmes from the studios at Shepherd's Bush, London, for example, go by cables to microwave transmitters on top of BT's telecom tower. They are beamed to receiving stations from where they travel by cable to BBC transmitters. The BBC has already built some microwave links to connect transmitters in areas which British Telecom doesn't consider sufficiently profitable to cover. Mr. Checkland appears to be considering a substantial increase in this capability to free the corporation from its reliance on BT. Mr. Checkland's good housekeeping move comes as he prepares to put the final touches to the BBC's future budgetary plans. The criticism of BT by the BBC is the latest attack from big business. Earlier this month, the Telecommunications Managers Association, representing BT's top 300 business customers, produced a scathing report on the company's record. And that was from a report published this Easter Saturday by Richard Evans, media editor of the Times newspaper.
Innovative information-based radio, 6220 daytime, 1611 nighttime. This is Radio Facts, the trade station, number one, High Ash Farm, K-Store St. Edmund, England, NR148RH.
Audio news presented by Roger Tate. And in this edition, we're taking a look at the new compact disc players that have recently been made available by Technics, who have introduced three new models. They all feature 18-bit DACs, or digital-to-analog converters. Now, Technics claim that the new 18-bit DACs give better performance with low-level signals, and they're incorporating no less than four of these new digital-to-analog converters in each new machine. Now, two of the DACs are used in each channel, one for the positive half of the waveform and one for the negative half. A new LSI chip has been designed to control these new DACs, with their outputs being differentially combined. Well, that's what the press release says. To be honest, I can't make much head nor tail of it. The signal path shows an 18-bit digital filter, followed by a group of four 16-bit DACs. Now, how this can be described as being 18-bit, four times oversampled, I'm at a bit of a loss to say. What is easier to tell you is that the model numbers of the new players, they're to be called the SLP-550, the SLP-770 and the SLP-990. And they're slowly trickling through to Technics dealers in the United Kingdom right now. They all feature the new high-resolution circuitry. The SLP-550 is the basic model, offering full remote control, 32-track memory and direct track access. Only two of the new DACs are actually used in this player, which also features digital output terminals to marry up with the latest generation of digital input amplifiers from Technics, which we'll mention on another broadcast. The SLP-770 offers more facilities, as well as 4 DAC resolution. The direct track access is complemented by a 2-speed manual search dial, and unusually a digital peak level meter. Yes, you can have peak level meters on CD players nowadays. Music scan, peak level search, whatever that might be, and an anti-vibration chassis are all facilities offered by the new SLP-770. Top of the trio comes the SLP-990. It's got the same rugged look as the other two models, and basically it's the same type of facilities offered on that one. However, it's built on a 17-pound 5-layer base and 3-layer top chassis to give the player total freedom from vibration effects. So it's definitely a CD player for you stronger hi-fi fans out there, because it needs a couple of people to lift the blinking thing. Now, these new players look interesting, and they sound quite reasonable on first listening tests. They're priced at around £299, £349 and £449 for each of the three models respectively. Availability is from, well, late March 1988. I've seen a few getting into the shops in London around about now. And I look forward to unravelling the complexities of 18-bit quad DACs on one of our next reports.
That report by Roger Tate. The European Commission is to publish a green paper on satellite communications in the autumn, which is likely to contain proposals that will threaten the monopolies of national telecommunications operators. The Commission has made clear that it wants greater liberalisation of satellite telecommunications than is planned for the land-based systems. It is under pressure to liberalise the sending and receiving of data communications signals via satellite. Allowing companies and organisations to provide two-way data communications would encroach on the monopolies of the national telecommunications operators. It would go much further, for example, than the recent decision of the British government to grant 6 licences for one-way data communications by satellite within the UK. This only allows information to be sent up from a point in the UK and transmitted down to a specific group of people who want the service. The people who want such liberalisation are large user organisations who would benefit from competition amongst those who would provide the two-way data communications and companies who make equipment for sending and receiving the data. The Green Paper is likely to stop short of suggesting that the market for voice telephony via satellite should be liberalised. This would meet with stronger opposition from national governments, particularly from Western Germany. According to a study group set up by the International Bar Association, the major weaknesses in the Commission's existing Green Paper on Telecommunications, published earlier this year, is that its proposals do not touch on the satellite part of the industry. The group believes that the impact that satellite and ground-based communications will have on each other are so great that regulation of the industry should be treated as one issue. A spokesman said that satellite communications should have been included in the light of the far-reaching effects they may have on the regulation of the ground-based systems. One critical area for the future will be satellites that carry out the switching of telephone calls in space, rather than just receiving and passing on the telecommunications signals, for example. If the switching of voice telephony could be carried out in space, the study group suggests it could remove it from the jurisdiction of national governments, and that could finally raise the possibility of competition for the existing national operators in voice telephony. The recently published EC Green Paper on terrestrial telecommunications has already caused consternation in some European governments because of its ambitious timescales for liberalising the market for communications equipment. And that was a report by Mary Fagan, technology correspondent of The Independent.
Mailed to us a few weeks ago by the Independent Broadcasting Authority, just before the satellite and cable exhibition at Wembley Conference Centre, a glossy brochure entitled DMAC / Packet, the UK standard for DBS. The headlines on the front of this brochure: component vision format giving clearer, sharper pictures than PAL or CCAM, free from cross-colour and cross-luminance. Optional widescreen 16:9 aspect ratio picture transmission with display of the appropriate 4:3 aspect ratio portion on receivers with conventional displays. High rate digital data burst of 20.25 megabits per second for maximum flexibility. Up to 8 high quality 15 kilohertz bandwidth sound channels. Additional teletext and data services. Scrambling for conditional access. Single wire baseband format with closely matched bandwidth requirements for both time compressed vision and duo binary data of about 8.5 MHz. FM satellite transmission or AM VSB cable distribution. Simplified receiver design with a single demodulator equally suitable for both vision and data. Well, this informative document, which describes the entire DMAC standard, is available from Independent Broadcasting Authority, Crawley Court, Winchester, Hampshire, SO212QA in England, and from the IBA's Engineering Bulletin, more on DMAC packet. When UK DBS begins towards the end of next year, a new transmission system will be used, known as DMAC packet. This gives a number of significant improvements compared to the conventional PAL system. Pictures will be clearer and sharper, with no colour subcarrier to cause cross-colour. With a special receiver, there is even the possibility of widescreen pictures with an aspect ratio of 16:9. But there is no need to throw away conventional sets. They will continue to display ordinary shaped pictures in the normal way. Pictures can easily be scrambled to allow for subscription television. The sound is digital with up to 8 high-quality sound channels. The digital signals can also be used to give a variety of teletext and other data services delivered as individually labelled packets of 751 bits. MAC stands for Multiplexed Analog Components. It does away with the colour subcarrier and instead uses a method of time compression. Each line of separate colour difference and luminance information is, in effect, squeezed so that during each transmitted line there is room to put first the colour difference and then the luminance. In place of conventional sync pulses, a duo binary data signal is inserted into the line blanking intervals. Whereas binary data can be at one of two levels, a duo binary signal can be at one of three levels and takes up less bandwidth. It is then frequency modulated along with the time compressed vision signal. The short bursts of data at the beginning of each line give a high overall capacity of about 3 megabits per second. It is used for a wide variety of purposes, including sound and teletext. So, what does it all mean for the satellite receiver of the future? The dish aerial, typically 30 to 45 centimeters in diameter, picks up signals received in the 12 gigahertz band. At the dish, the entire block of frequencies from 11.7 to 12.5 GHz is converted to an IF range 950 to 1750 MHz. These signals are then fed to the indoor satellite receiver, which tunes to the correct channel and demodulates the FM DMAC signal. The indoor unit also contains the MAC Vision decoder to reconstruct the picture and digital processing for the sound. The signals would be fed to the existing television set, preferably using the 21-pin peritelevision connector. This preserves the vision signal in red, green and blue component form and avoids the cross-colour effects of PAL. The complete DBS receiver with dish is likely to cost just a few hundred pounds. But some countries are planning to use the D2 MAC system. This is part of the family of MAC systems approved by the European Broadcasting Union. The picture part of D2 Mac is the same as that of DMac, but it carries only half the data. That is, about 1.5 megabits per second, and gives a maximum of only 4 high-quality sound channels instead of 8. The digital data burst of D2 Mac is at 10.125 megabits per second instead of the 20.25 of DMac, so the data signal can be carried in a lower bandwidth. D2 Mac was originally intended for narrowband cable systems where it is not possible to fit DMac in. At baseband, D2 Mac needs at least 5 MHz compared to 8.5 MHz for DMac. But D2 Mac data does not make full use of the bandwidth available on the satellite channel, and it is much less flexible in offering half the possible number of sound channels and data services. Although the vision part of D2 Mac is the same as DMac, a D2 Mac receiver will not be able to receive DMac. On the other hand, it is quite easy to make a DMac receiver that can receive D2 Mac. The integrated circuits have already been designed, and they are expected to go into production shortly, in time for manufacturers to build receivers for the start of BSB's programs in the autumn of next year.
As long ago as January 1988, Raymond Snoddy of the Financial Times wrote an article tuning in to the radio diversity ahead of us in the months to come, and here are some extracts from it. Under a new radio authority, which will take over the regulation of commercial radio from the IBA, local stations will be able to broadcast more or less what they want, subject to minimum technical standards and requirements of accuracy, balance and decency. Under threat, a full IBA meeting decided to re-emphasise the IBA belief that it had the skills and experience to take the proposed new radio system forward, saying that it will continue to press for a system that will provide the best service for UK listeners. Applicants for the national channels will first have to demonstrate that their plans widen consumer choice and offer internal variety. 24 hours a day pop stations need not apply. After that, the 8-year licences will go to the highest bidder. The hope is that the new national channels will lead the way in an explosion in the number of stations, which is matched by a similar explosion in advertising revenue. There will probably be no shortage of applicants for the national channels. Runners-up are already identifying themselves. Carlton Communications, Capital and Mr. Richard Branson's Virgin Group are all expected to bid. So too are Red Rose Radio, a successful commercial radio station in the Preston and Blackpool area, and Chalford Communications, the Australian broadcasting company, which has a 49% stake in LBC and minority interests in 12 other ILR stations. Several hundred applications of varying degrees of seriousness are expected for local and community of interest licences. The big battle will, however, come over the new national channels. Mr. David Maker, Managing Director of Red Rose, which controls ILR stations, Radio Air in Leeds and Red Dragon in Cardiff, plans to set up a new 50-50 joint venture with Mr. Andrew Lloyd Webber's Really Useful Company to bid for a channel combining light classical music with a strong news output and educational material. It won't quite be the Guardian or the Independent of the air, but not far off, Mr. Maker said. Yet although there has been general welcome for the concept of more and diverse radio in the UK, a number of serious questions remain. For instance, is it wise to specify that each of the national channels should display internal variety when the trend in countries like the United States has been towards single-format radio channels targeted at a particular audience segment such as all classical or all reggae radio? Is it wise to put the national channels out to the highest bidder, after an initial test programme qualifying test, effectively excluding all but substantial companies? How do you value a national frequency? Is it worth £5 million or £20 million? Asked Mr. Robert Devereux, Managing Director of Virgin Communications, who fears that even companies like his own, which have specialised knowledge, may be outbid by major new players who have yet to disclose their hand. Will advertising expand fast enough to finance the new diversity? And how will the increased competition affect the BBC, which has been told to get on with the provision of public service broadcasting? The corporation will, however, have to hand over two of its national frequencies to commercial broadcasting by ending simulcasting, the simultaneous broadcasting of the same programme on both medium wave and VHF, to increase audience reach and reception. Dr. Brian Sturgis, advertising analyst at stockbrokers BZW, is sceptical that the market will grow fast enough to pay for all the choice that is theoretically available. BZW is forecasting that the total UK advertising cake, estimated at £5.8 billion in 1987, will show real growth of 7% this year. Even if radio doubled its share, which would be a great achievement, it wouldn't be enough, says Mr. Sturgis. Mrs. Jocelyn Hay, chairman of the Voice of the Listener, an organisation set up to support quality in sound broadcasting, has worries of a different and deeper kind. The government, she says, has combined some of the worst elements of the American system with the worst of the French and Italian systems in terms of numbers of stations. There are 10,230 radio stations in the United States, between 20 and 30 in most large cities. But although there is enormous diversity of music and language, radio drama is virtually non-existent, and documentary and analysis a rarity. In France, the Commission Nationale de la Communication et de Liberté, modelled on America's FCC, is engaged in a tortuous process of re-regulating the country region by region after a vast explosion of local radio in the early 1980s brought near chaos with competing stations trying to blast each other off the air. Mrs. Hayes believes in extra choice. She's afraid, however, that intensified competition for the listener, combined with shortage of money at the BBC due to a licence fee linked to the retail price index, could result in the loss of what she believes is the best about British radio: in-depth news, documentaries and specialist magazine programmes like Science Now, Analysis and File on 4. To Mr. David Roberts in Flint, however, a North Wales town with a population of 15,000, hit by the decline of traditional industries, local radio is an opportunity to boost the self-confidence of the community. Mr. Roberts chairs Flint Community Radio, which brings together local organisations such as the Choir, the Citizens Advice Bureau and the RSPCC. He is critical of the restrictions on radio broadcasting. At the moment, he says, people stay at home, they watch television and they know more about what's going on in the outside world than in their own community. But if the broadcasting bill receives royal assent, as is expected by the summer of 1989, applications for new stations will begin to flood in. By the 1990s, when Britain possesses hundreds of local community radio stations, Mr. Roberts' view of the British radio listening public will be very different indeed. And that was an extract of an article printed last January in the Financial Times and penned by Mr. Raymond Snoddy.
miss her much, well, hey, never gave her too much thought in your newspaper grades. A waste away tomorrow, babe. I saved your body, but your mind paid. And money is for taking, yes, and rich is what to be forsaken.
To those of you who might have been watching last night's trial of Sir Richard Hollis on LWT at 9:15, may be interested to know that made television history. A report in The Independent says that a television programme broadcast examined whether the late Sir Roger Hollis, the former head of MI5, was a Russian spy, was actually cleared in advance by the Treasury solicitor to ensure against a last-minute injunction banning transmission. The action by London Weekend Television is believed to be the first time a major broadcaster has sought advanced clearance. A company spokesman confirmed that the Treasury Solicitor's Office had been informed of the £1 million programme. People working on it believe that the tape or a transcript has been shown, but the spokesman said nobody was available to confirm or deny this.
From ProSound News, commercial radio for Greece. Eddystone Radio, a division of Marconi Communication Systems based in Birmingham, is to supply VHF FM transmitting equipment to the first commercial radio station in Greece. Top FM will be situated on Mount Parnes, northwest of Athens, serving the Athens-Piraeus Basin area, which has a population of around 2.5 million people. The order is made up of a 4 kilowatt 1708 solid state stereo FM transmitter and studio to transmitter link gear.
The BBC has been accused of discriminating against women and acting like a Victorian employer by Janice Long, the disc jockey whose programme was axed 4 weeks after the birth of her son. According to Ms. Long, the corporation felt it would be inappropriate for her to return to work so too soon after the birth. They asked whether I could possibly combine being a mother with doing a single half-hour slot on a Sunday. If that is not discrimination, I don't know what is, she said. Miss Long, who wanted only 6 weeks maternity leave, said she'd been advised to take 4 months. They said, don't be silly. You're a woman. You'll change your mind and you'll want to stay at home to breastfeed, she claimed. Miss Long, 32, was the first woman disc jockey on Radio 1 to have a daily programme. She had presented it for 3 years when it was dropped last month. Yesterday, in a move which took the BBC by surprise, Miss Long announced that she would be leaving the corporation. Mr. Johnny Beerling, controller of Radio 1, said yesterday, "We've been talking to Janice about a number of different programmes, including a regular Sunday show, and we're sorry that she's apparently decided not to take up any of these offers." That was a report in the Daily Telegraph on Saturday, the 2nd of April.
We're on the air to demonstrate the kind of service we will be providing every day of the week, starting during the summer. What we are seeking is a licence to transmit from the United Kingdom instead of hiring transmission facilities abroad. If you would like our specially printed QSL card, please send 50 pence in British stamps or 3 international reply coupons to Radio Fax, number 1, High Ash Farm, Case Store St Edmund, England, NR148RH. And don't forget that every letter we receive helps our application for a licence to transmit from England.
Video news presented by Roger Tate. And in this edition, we'll be taking a look at a new camcorder from Panasonic called the NV-M7B. Now, I'd say that Panasonic are getting quite a name for having irons in every fire. Many critics assumed that the release of their mini VHS C-format camcorders pretty well sounded the death knell for full-sized machines taking the conventional VHS cassettes. But it doesn't seem to be the case, because the company has just released a new machine called the NV-M7. The camcorder is due for release around about now, around about Easter time. And remarkably, it offers more facilities than its predecessor machines, but without the inevitable increase in price. Maybe the camcorder market is becoming even more competitive than ever. Anyway, whatever the reason, the new Panasonic NV-M7 certainly seems to offer a lot. Its weight is quite light, which is important when you're lugging it around all day. And its low weight is made possible by the use of what they call a CCD image device, rather than the old-fashioned Vidicon tube, so it's also less susceptible to being burnt out if somebody in the family points it up at the sun. The minimum light level for usable shots is in the order of 10 lux, which is pretty low really, with ghosting and flaring being what the manufacturers describe as being virtually eliminated. Now, one thing which is rather new is the flying erase head. Now, this method of enabling smooth transitions from each shot is usually only found on professional video cassette recorders, the sort of thing that broadcast companies use. But now it's made an entry into the domestic market. Unlike a fixed erase head, the flying erase head, as they call it, is fitted very, very close to the record heads, ensuring a very smooth, noiseless switch from scene to scene. Auto-tracing white balance is what Panasonic described their method of adjusting the colour, and this is provided on the NV-M7. It gives fully automatic control of colour balance, and I'm told it works quite well. Although, it'll be interesting to see if Panasonic have managed to get around the problem of giving rather bluish results, which has been my experience with their previous camcorders that use this system. Autofocus is also provided, which I suppose is necessary for 90% of all the people that use camcorders who don't seem to be able to focus them. And it's claimed to be quick and responsive, even under poor lighting conditions. And that's the key word, poor lighting conditions. I found that sometimes in dark lighting, autofocus is worse than useless, because it goes hunting back and forth. Perhaps the most useful facility of this new NV-M7 is that an electronic character generator is supplied as part of the total package, and it's not at any extra cost. This gives 125 different characters in up to 11 different languages, with auto date, a stopwatch, and much more. The arrival of this new NV-M7, or NV-M7B as they're calling it in the UK, will surely put paid to the rumours that Panasonic were phasing out camcorders that use the large VHS tapes. We're going to bring you a test on this camcorder as soon as possible. But in the meantime, if you'd like some information about it, you can of course contact Panasonic UK Limited, 300 to 318 Bath Road, Slough, in Berkshire. That's Panasonic UK, 300 to 318 Bath Road, Slough, in Berkshire. Their telephone number is 0753, that's the STD code in the UK, 34522. This has been Roger Tate reporting on the new NV-M7B camcorder from Panasonic.
And now a report by Richard Elan in Studio Week magazine, entitled Radio for Sale. I'm not a great fan of the present government, and we don't need to go into the reasons here. However, there is one point on which I have disagreed with governments of both colours for a very long time, and that is the subject of broadcasting. My argument with the current government on this topic is that they are too far to my right. However, on the contrary, I think their plans don't go far enough, as far as radio is concerned anyway. And the latest announcements from Douglas Hurd a few weeks ago give me even more cause for concern. I am old enough to remember the offshore pirates of the 60s, and if you can remember them too, and a rosy, nostalgic glow comes over your mind as you recall better broadcasting times, then I suggest you find some old tapes and listen to them. You'll find the offshore stations awful by modern standards. We must keep our memories in perspective. Those stations were very important, and they represented a new and vital approach to broadcasting, but we don't need them back. I can remember the last broadcast from Radio London on August the 14th, 1967, and all that stuff. I particularly remember how angry I was with the government of the day for introducing the Marine Offences Act 1967, which closed down almost the last of the stations. The BBC may have annexed a lot of the offshore DJs for its new popular music service almost exactly 20 years ago, when the Home and Light and Third gave way to Numbers. But as they must have realised, and other stations after them, pinching presenters from a ship doesn't mean your station will have the same liveliness and atmosphere as an insecure, pioneering offshore broadcaster on the run from the government. What nobody has ever been interested in asking, at any official level at least, is why we need the offshore stations in the first place, or the onshore pirates that followed them and which still exist to this day, despite harassment on account of their flouting of the 1949 Wireless Telegraphy Act. The reason is simply those stations had and have vast audiences because the official stations don't do the job. While the introduction of Radio 1 and later the BBC local stations helped a great deal, the introduction of the so-called independence stations did not, and through no fault of their own. The reason is that they're non-specialised. The BBC networks are largely devoted to offering a different type of service on each channel, and it is the specialisation that has made the BBC radio the envy of the world. Rightly so. The BBC local stations are specialists too. A long time ago, undercapitalisation forced them out of the music radio market in any serious sense, and they decided to get closer to the communities they serve, and they're very good at it. But the ILR stations are not specialist. They aren't really allowed to be, despite gallant attempts such as Capital Radio, split AM and FM services. The brief is to be all things to all listeners, and the ILR stations have enough money to try it, worse luck. They fail miserably. Not because they aren't any good at broadcasting. They operate to the same high standard as any other bit of the British broadcasting system. But because they have an impossible task. It is impossible to be all things to all people on a radio station. Honest. So when I see Douglas Hurd's new plans for radio, I begin to cringe still more. I'm not against national commercial radio, per se. It has to be proved to me that we need it, but that's another matter. Although the proposals pay lip service to the idea of choice and specialisation, including the possibility of national classical or talk commercial stations, they specifically exclude a popular station.
Cheerio, cheerio, baby.
say that you love me madly. Well, babe, I'll accept you gladly.
Community stations, assuming that they are allowed to exist this time and don't get cancelled at the last minute because they would be owned once again by people of the wrong political colour, will be able to specialise, but they will have even less money than BBC local stations and are hardly going to be a major musical radio force. They won't be able to afford it. What the Home Secretary is missing, and what a large proportion of the British public is missing, is diversity of popular music programming. Top 40 radio is only one such area. There's more to music radio than a simple division between popular and unpopular. Overall, British broadcasting is poised to become too complicated. It also suffers, even now, from having too many people broadcasting more of the same. National more of the same commercial stations will simply compete with the ILR stations to the detriment of both. What is needed instead, whether on national, regional, all local radio stations, is more specialisation, particularly in the music field. With that in mind, here are some proposals for British radio. Radio 1 to specialise in top 40 only, 24 hours a day on AM. Radio 3 to operate on FM only. A general rule to be established that, except in special cases, example Radio 4, no station should broadcast the same programming on AM and FM. No station obliged to operate both AM and FM services. These suggestions deal effectively with any need for frequencies anywhere in Britain. Needle time agreements to be replaced by blanket licensing agreements to ensure that music radio is as difficult or easy to do as well as talk radio. Whether local or community, regional or national, stations are obliged to specialise in an area of programming, music or otherwise. Licences to be issued on a similar basis to that in the United States, primary concerns being that a frequency is available and that the programming would make a worthwhile contribution. There would have to be a good reason why you shouldn't set up a station rather than a good reason why you should. IBA to lightly regulate all non-BBC broadcasting. There's no need for extra regulatory bodies. BBC guaranteed an inflation-proof level of funding via the licence fee as a national service, but able to include other methods of funding at the decision of the BBC and not the government, e.g. subscriptions, commercials, etc. Stations to own their own transmitters, STLs and other facilities. Stations, including BBC stations, to fund their activities by any means they choose, commercials, subscriptions, charitable status, etc. Viability of stations other than BBC outlets, it could be argued that BBC Radio 1 and 2 should be included here also, to be determined by market forces. Large or small, if people like them, they will gain audiences and survive. Otherwise, they will fail. Licensing regulations to be biased in favour of giving people a chance to try something new and different. There are obviously a few loose ends to tighten up, but that's the general idea. Like it? Well, those were extracts from an article written by Richard Elan in Studio Week in the March issue.
Interested in improving AM reception? We will be producing a high-performance synchronous detector circuit board, which is designed to greatly improve reception quality of weak or selectively fading AM signals. The board is designed to accept a 455 GHz IF input at any level, so it will suit most communications receivers. There are two selector switches. The first sets the phase lock loop bandwidth, wide, medium or narrow. Where signals are fading rapidly and the carrier phase changes quickly, or where the carrier is phase modulated with data, as on the various long wave services, then the wider loop characteristics must be used. The second switch has six positions. Position 1 is a low distortion envelope detector. Position 2 is normal double sideband synchronous detection. Position 3 gives upper sideband, and position 4 gives lower sideband. Position 5 is called stereo spread and gives fascinating effects with upper sideband on the left and lower sideband on the right. Position 6 is also unique in giving quadrature, which means that the modulation from the strongest station on the channel is nulled out, so any station beneath can be heard more clearly. Synchronous reception reduces the distortion experienced with a selectively fading signal, but does not help with the objectionable surging in audio level. The final unique feature, then, of this board is that it includes a broadcast quality audio limiter with multiple time constants, which controls the peak audio level. Of course, another benefit of synchronous reception is the signal-to-noise improvement, which results from rejection of noise and interference not in phase with the received signal carrier. The production board will not be ready until July and will be around £150. But if you would like to be on the mailing list for details, send along 1 13-pence British stamp or 1 international reply coupon to Radio Facts, Number 1, High Ash Farm, K-Store St. Edmund, England, NR148RH.
Took you so long. You
from the Sunday Times. A report that Government Minister Timothy Renton has announced that pirate radio stations who do not close down will not be given community radio licences. This is a reversal of previously announced government policy that unlicensed stations could apply for licences. Where does this leave the Shetland Islands Broadcasting Company, operating since November the 26th without a licence, and widely regarded as the only contender?
Scottish Television has unashamedly turned from broadcasting to narrowcasting in the early hours of this Monday morning. While the rest of ITV is showing movies and videos, Scottish Television is screening the first of a monthly series of three-hour Scottish verse readings, for which 50 poets have already been booked. The brainchild of programme editor Mike Grieve, it will be uncompromising television, with poet framed head and shoulders against a black background. Executive producer Alistair Moffat said, "I'd be delighted if we got even 10,000 viewers, but that would still make it the biggest poetry reading ever." So said The Times on April the 2nd.
From Asia Pacific Broadcasting and Telecommunications, CCD-based cameras take off, by Vicky Hyde. For a long time, cameras based on charge-coupled devices, CCD technology, have been relegated to the factory floor for use in industrial television, monitoring factory procedures and providing security systems. Despite the technological superiority of the CCD-based machines, it was not possible to use them in studio applications because of initial problems with low resolution. This shortcoming has been swept aside, however, and a new generation of television has arrived that uses CCDs to provide high-quality images without the attendant problems associated with standard tube-based products. The field has really taken off in the last 6 months or so, with most of the major Japanese manufacturers now producing CCD studio cameras which are gaining increasing attention both from the Japanese broadcasting industry and from overseas organisations. One industry spokesman said that the CCD camera field is considered to be a major area of intensive development in the next few years, with companies vying to produce light, cheap camera systems of high quality and high strength. This could, he said, help to revolutionise the broadcasting industry by enabling a far greater degree of mobility to cameramen than they have at present, and by providing broadcast quality equipment to the smaller studios for a relatively small capital investment. CCD technology allows the cameras to avoid the problems of image burn-in and lag common with conventional cameras. In addition, the CCD machines are impervious to shock and vibration and have permanent registration, making them popular for outdoor applications.
A report from The Independent indicates that British Telecom announced that it's freezing its main telephone service charges for the whole of the 1988-89 financial year. Exchange line rentals and connection charges, all local and national telephone calls, internationally dialed telephone calls and payphone charges will be held at the current level until 31st of March 1989. British Telecom will also be proposing shortly to Ofttel, the communications watchdog, a new lifeline scheme that will reduce the exchange line rental shares for those who depend on the telephone but can least afford it.
These engineering tests have been on 6220, which is within the 49-metre band extension, already widely used by several countries, proposed at WARC 1979 and likely to be ratified by all nations at the next conference. 1611 was used for 30 years, ending 10 years ago by Portishead Radio, and since then has been disused in the British Isles. Vatican Radio is the only user in the whole of Europe.